the Crystal Cathedral declares bankruptcy. A new campaign speaks to gay youth. A champion for the unborn dies. Can we see the end of the book? And Lady Thatcher fights yet another battle. It's Wednesday, September 20, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The bankruptcy declaration by California's Crystal Cathedral became headline news almost as soon as it was declared, and for obvious reasons. This church, established by the now-famous Reverend Robert Schuller, became famous for its message of prosperity theology. Its famed building, designed by architect Philip Johnson, was supposed to be a symbol of that prosperity thinking and of God's financial blessings that were supposedly promised to all his followers. Now, as the church is reeling from a succession of crises, including the removal of the younger Robert Schuller from the church's pastorate over a disagreement with his father about the future of the ministry, the ministry is headed by Schuller's daughter, Sheila Schuller Coleman, who is now identified as the church's senior pastor. Ms. Coleman said that, quote, outreach and operations, end quote, would continue, as would the Hour of Power, the country's longest-running religious television broadcast. Rebecca Cathcart of the New York Times reports that the church simply could not afford to pay its bills. Bills the New York Times estimates at debts of $55 million and, as are estimated by the Los Angeles Times, over $44 million, of which $36 million is a mortgage on the church's famous glass sanctuary, known as the Crystal Cathedral. Ms. Coleman, in making a statement about the church's bankruptcy, said budgets could not be cut fast enough to keep up with the unprecedented rapid decline in revenues due to the recession. Now, whether or not the decline in revenues is due to the recession, the reality is that the church lost 30% of its revenue in just 1 year, the year 2009. But observers of these ministries have noted a precipitous and steady decline over the last several decades. The removal of Dr. Robert Schuller from his position as the senior pastor of the church undoubtedly led to deep questions about the future of the ministry. But more than that, it appears that the aging membership of the church, and quite frankly, changes in the larger society, drew immediate attention to the fact that the Crystal Cathedral wasn't actually meeting its promises. It wasn't even paying its bills. Now, all that would be embarrassing enough for any Christian ministry, but for the Crystal Cathedral, it is downright devastating. This is a church that was established upon the premise of prosperity theology. Not quite so crudely expressed as is found in some tent ministries and late-night TV preachers who promise that if you'll just send in a certain donation of seed faith, God will shower you with blessings. No, in a far more culturally advanced way, the Reverend Robert Schuller pioneered a more high-class, white-collar form of prosperity theology. He spoke largely to a generation of World War II, the greatest generation, who saw prosperity as a matter of their American inheritance and perhaps of their spiritual inheritance as well. Robert Schuller was not known merely for prosperity theology, however. As embarrassing as that now is, since his church cannot even pay the mortgage on the building that was supposed to be the great symbol of God's promises of prosperity. More devastatingly than the fact that he taught a version of prosperity theology is what Robert Schuller actually did with the gospel, with the scriptures, and with the entire structure of Christian theology. In his book, Self-Esteem, The New Reformation, Schuller basically argued almost 30 years ago that the Bible's message is not really about our redemption from sin, but rather our salvation from the primal sin, which he identified as a lack of self-esteem. What you end up with here is a form of theological liberalism married to a form of prosperity theology packaged in a way that fit the culture of Southern California in the 1970s and 80s and obviously created a major television presence with audience in the 80s and the 90s. But all that is now passing. It's not just the factor of an economic recession. As a matter of fact, historians of American religion will point out that many of the earliest prosperity gospel preachers actually found their great rise during the Great Depression. They were hardly hampered by a time of want. Indeed, their message of prosperity seemed to find traction among those who had the very least at the time. Perhaps it is the fact now that prosperity theology is a tough sell when people have actually bought it, bought into it, and found it wanting. The reality here, however, is that the indebtedness of the Crystal Cathedral, and now its financial bankruptcy, is far less embarrassing to the church, or at least should be less embarrassing, than the theological bankruptcy of its message. Now, the secular media, of all things, seems to be zeroing in on that, as an editorial in the Los Angeles Times at least acknowledges that this bankruptcy is particularly embarrassing for this congregation, given its message. In one odd twist added to the story, it turns out that the television ministry will continue even as the church tries to figure out how to pay for the building, which is now more or less a television set. The recent suicides of at least four young men struggling with their sexual identity, who were struggling certainly with homosexual feelings, who found themselves in a position of despair and embarrassment, well, these suicides have prompted some gay rights activists to form a project which is holding out the message that it gets better. Dan Savage, a Seattle-based sex columnist and homosexual activist, came up with the project after he heard in the news about these suicides. Mr. Savage spoke of the suicide of 15-year-old Billy Lucas in Indiana, and he told USA Today, quote, "I thought if I could only have talked to him for 5 minutes to tell him it gets better, maybe he wouldn't be dead," end quote. The videos in the It Gets Better campaign contain a very short and understandable message, and that is this: if you just get through your adolescent years, if you just can get through middle school and high school, it gets better. By this message, the spokespersons on these videos hope to communicate to young people struggling with their sexual identity that the angst and turmoil and bullying of adolescence will not be the truth for the rest of their lives. One of the deep tragedies of this recent spate of suicides is that these young men were so very young. Two were 13-year-old boys, one was 15, and the other was 18-year-old Tyler Clementi, the freshman at Rutgers University who committed suicide after his sexual encounter in his dorm room was broadcast on the internet by his roommate. No one can doubt that these young men were indeed suffering at the hands of their own friends and classmates. Adolescence is a very cruel period of life, unnecessarily cruel, given the fact that many adults give tacit approval or at least stand back with a see no evil, hear no evil, do no evil approach, even as they know that teenagers are harassing each other, bullying each other, and making the lives of some of their fellow teenagers virtually unlivable. No one can condone this kind of behavior, and these particular suicides cry out for the attentiveness of all concerned persons, and especially of evangelical Christians, to be aware of the deep pain that is being experienced by so many people around us, especially in this case, adolescents and young adults, whose harassment is just adding injury to a very difficult period of their lives, especially for those who are trying to figure out the very difficult issues of sexual orientation and how that fits into their larger worldview and self-understanding. Christians have a particular burden here because even as we know it is our responsibility to communicate both gospel and redemptive truth, that redemptive truth requires us to tell young people that homosexuality is not God's intention for their lives. There is so much more to unpack here, but the reality is that these videos are an understandable response if your worldview is indeed shaped by the normalization of homosexuality. It's not just homosexual activists who will see this kind of approach as being valuable and necessary, but those who merely believe that the normalization of homosexuality is either right or, at least, unavoidable. Now, one of the interesting facets of this new campaign is the participation of the Right Reverend V. Gene Robinson. You'll recall that he is the openly homosexual Episcopal Bishop of New Hampshire, the man whose election to this office has rent the entire Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion asunder. In his own video, Bishop Robinson tells young people that God loves them as they are and doesn't want them to change. Now, with that particular video, we run head-on into the great collision of worldviews and understandings. Indeed, the great collisions between the gospel of Jesus Christ and the false gospel of liberal theology. What Bishop Robinson is saying here is what those who call for the full acceptance of homosexuality now demand, looking to those who believe themselves to be homosexual and saying to them, God made you just as you are, and he doesn't want you to change. But the reality is that Christians can't say that to anyone, certainly not to ourselves. We understand that God takes sin with deadly, eternal seriousness, and he calls upon all persons to change. But the change is not something we can effect within ourselves. It is the grace that he effects within our lives through the redemption accomplished by Jesus Christ. The Christian gospel is not the message of how we can identify certain activities as sins and others as worse sins. Rather, it is the message of how sinners come to be saved through the atonement accomplished by the Lord Jesus Christ. And that means that all of us are found guilty. None of us can be told you are just the way God made you and God doesn't want you to change. This message, so clearly summarized by Bishop Robinson, also should have our attention for this reason. This will be the bottom line demand of those who want persons to be right-minded according to the new prevailing morality on homosexuality. Those younger evangelicals who now say that they don't want to make homosexuality an issue, they still believe it's a sin, but they don't want to make it an issue, will have to face the fact that what they're going to be presented with is the demand that they not only remain quiet about the sinfulness of homosexuality, but that they say exactly what Bishop Robinson here has said. God made you this way, and He doesn't want you to change. That message is antithetical to the gospel of Jesus Christ. The death of Dr. Mildred Jefferson at the age of 84 brings now to silence the voice of one of the most articulate defenders of human dignity and the rights of the unborn ever to live. Dr. Mildred Jefferson was the first black woman to graduate from the Harvard Medical School. When the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973 legalized abortion on demand, her declaration was that this judicial decision turned her profession into a killing profession. She said this, quote, "With the obstetrician and mother becoming the worst enemies of the child and the pediatrician becoming the assassin for the family, the state must be enabled to protect the life of the child born and unborn." The Roe v. Wade decision, she said, gave my profession an almost unlimited license to kill. She made those comments in testimony before the United States Congress in 1981. From 1975 to 1978, Dr. Jefferson served three terms as president of the National Right to Life Committee. Her voice was one of the most articulate and powerful ever to speak to the issue of abortion. In a 2003 profile in the American Feminist, that is an anti-abortion magazine, Dr. Jefferson said, and I quote, "I am at once a physician, a citizen, and a woman, and I am not willing to stand aside and allow this concept of expendable human lives to turn this great land of ours into just another exclusive reservation where only the perfect, the privileged, and the planned have the right to live." End quote. May God bless the memory of Dr. Mildred Jefferson. And may her voice continue through statements like these to reach the conscience of the American people. For many years, Nicholas Negroponte was head of MIT's famed Media Lab. It was he who 30 years ago declared the great transformation from atoms to bits. He pointed to the digital revolution before anyone else had seen it and suggested that it would fundamentally change the way we communicate, the way we record history, the way we read and process information, and even the way we play. Now, in an interview with CNN's Howard Kurtz on Reliable Sources, Mr. Negroponte, who now leads the organization One Laptop Per Child, says that the age of the book is over. The physical book's days are numbered, he said. It will be in 5 years, he told Mr. Kurtz. The physical medium cannot be distributed to enough people. When you go to Africa, 500,000 people want books. You can't send the physical thing, end quote. Now, this is what makes Mr. Negroponte's current argument so interesting. He is suggesting that in much of the developing world, the book that many people will first come to know is going to be a digital book. You simply can't keep up with the demand for printed books in much of the developing world. They're too expensive, they're too cumbersome, and it takes too long to get them processed for the people who are now demanding them. So he suggests that the e-book may find its greatest demand not in the advanced West, where people are gobbling up iPads, Kindles, and other digital reading devices, but in the developing world, where an insatiable desire for books and reading material will lead persons to accept them in digital form, knowing that otherwise they may never have them at all. Now, Mr. Negroponte, who is a keen observer of all of these technologies, makes another very interesting statement. He points to the fact that it was the developing world that largely leapt upon the cell phone revolution, even before many in the West understood the death of the telephone line, the landline, and the house phone. "That's what cell phones did," said Mr. Negroponte. "Cell phones were more popular in Cambodia and Uganda because they didn't have phones. We had phones in this country, and we were very late to the table. They're going to adopt e-books much faster than we do. End quote. I think Mr. Negroponte is probably onto something here. At the same time, I believe that most persons, if given the opportunity, very much want to hold a book, a physical book, a printed book. And I am by no means convinced that the book has only another 5 years of usefulness. As a matter of fact, I'm absolutely convinced that most people will want to continue to have books at hand if it is their option. I'm a user of ebooks. I'm now an avid user of ebooks, both on the iPad and on the Kindle. I've gone through several different Kindle technologies, and the current Kindle is one of the most amazing machines I've ever held in my hands. It holds 3,500 books. It holds a charge for about 30 days. I can get a book in less than a minute when I need something to read, I need documentation for an article, or I'm just interested in something and want to plan ahead and put it on my digital shelf. At the same time, the book is simply too invaluable as a printed form. But we need to remember something. Throughout much of human history, even modern Western history, books were so expensive that they, in their printed form, were largely the possessions of those who had the means, perhaps even the disposable income, to expend money on books rather than other things. That may be the state to which we return. We may be looking at a future in which the e-book becomes the standard fare and the printed book becomes something of a luxury. It'll be interesting to see how this turns out. In the meantime, I wouldn't discount anything Mr. Negroponte predicts. Britain's famed Iron Lady is fighting another battle. Lady Margaret Thatcher has been admitted to a London-area hospital after suffering an infection subsequent to a bout with the flu. She is so ill that she missed her 85th birthday celebration, which was held at 10 Downing Street, an event that she insisted must go forward, even if she was unable to attend. A spokesperson for Downing Street said, "We understand from Lady Thatcher's office that she has been admitted to hospital for precautionary tests following her recent bout of flu. The Prime Minister wishes Lady Thatcher a speedy recovery." End quote. Lady Margaret Thatcher is one of the most famed figures of the 20th century. The first female Prime Minister of Great Britain, she fell right in line with famed British leaders such as Elizabeth I and Queen Victoria in becoming the definition of her times. She, after all, became the great warrior prime minister in the Falklands War, and in her many years as prime minister, she fundamentally reshaped the entire culture and politics of the United Kingdom. I had the opportunity to meet Margaret Thatcher and to spend some time with her just a few years ago, and I found her just as exhilarating and fascinating as I knew she must be. Margaret Thatcher is one of the very last of her generation, a generation that fundamentally reshaped the world after World War II and, in her case, along with Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, after the end of the Cold War. I'm praying for Lady Thatcher's recovery as she fights yet another great fight. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmohler. I want you to know about Southern Seminary's annual Give Me an Answer Collegiate Conference, which will be held February 11 through 12 of 2011 here on the campus of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Our special guest will be C.J. Mahaney, and the theme will be Recalibrate. It's going to be a great opportunity for young people to gather together. We'll be looking at current issues in apologetics, and we'll be recalibrating our understandings on the basis of the Word of God as we look to the future, seeking to be faithful. That is February 11 through 12 of 2010. For more information, go to the website sbts.edu. I'll meet you tomorrow for The Briefing.